Okay, we talked about how, by the way, it's hot, and most of you didn't get to bed until 3:34, and it's going to be a rough one, so just try to concentrate, okay? We talked about the need to get ready in the break, okay? We talked about the need to get ready for meditation as if you were about to run like a 50-yard dash, and that there are some warm-ups you have to do. And I think this often makes the difference between successful meditation and a meditation that doesn't work. And this gets into preparing your mind and your body for meditation. Most of the decision of whether your meditation will be successful or not happens outside of meditation. You know what I mean? It doesn't have to do with whether or not you're able to concentrate during the meditation. It's whether or not you've set yourself up properly for meditation. And I think the reason that you meet people who say, I've been trying to meditate for 5 years or 6 years and I'm not able to do it very well is because they don't know how to warm up properly. It's like, really, it's like trying to run a race without having warmed up your body at all. So it's the same problem. Here we have six preliminaries, okay? Six practices that you should do before you start meditating. Inside of number five are seven more, okay? What we call the seven limbs or something like that, okay? Or the seven ingredients to a successful meditation. So we'll go through the six preliminary practices. And then inside of number five, we'll stop and we'll do seven ingredients or seven parts of a successful meditation. And that's all we'll do this afternoon, okay? I think it's important to remember that all of these preliminaries are happening in the space of a few minutes, you see? When I say that if you want to see emptiness, you have to meditate 1 or 2 hours per day, I'm not including this time for the warm-up. You see what I mean? Most of us, if you're a normal American, you only have about an hour before you have to go to work, you know, or an hour and a half. And so I'm speaking very much from the point of view of a person who worked in a corporation for 16 years and had a 1.5 hour commute each way. And we have to get practical. You know, what can a normal American do to do your meditation every day? If I outline some kind of preliminaries that's going to take you an hour and a half, I'm almost assuring that you will fail. You see what I mean? Because you won't have time. And you won't spend the time. You don't have the time. So the point is to do it properly and to do the warm-up properly, but to make it move at a decent rate of speed. You know what I mean? I think what happens to a lot of Americans is that you meet one lama and they give you one sadhana. And then you meet another lama and they give you another sadhana. And another lama says, you know, you really should do 100 of these every day. And then you meet another lama that says, oh, you have to do 50 of these every day. And then pretty soon you have 3 hours of practice that you can't possibly succeed. And you will fail. You'll give it up. And then you get this Judeo-Christian guilt complex for the next 6 years, you know. Like, you know, this is baggage from your old religion. That now you're a really evil person because you took all these commitments and you didn't do them, you know, and probably Buddha God is going to punish you, you know, and it's not like that, okay? You have to have a succinct, concise, effective practice that you don't keep loading up with new stuff, you know what I mean? You have to be something that you can do in the morning that moves quickly and effectively through certain warm-ups. And then you get straight to the meditation and you have an hour of solid, concentrated meditation. Okay, so we're going to do the preliminaries, but remember that I find personally that I spend 10 breaths on each one. You know, my alarm clock is, each one is done within 10 breaths. You have a, this is your, you know, this is your attention span during the hour that you have. And I'm not kidding, you know. It's something like when you start out, you're a little bit distracted and your mind's not too concentrated. And then you start to turn on, you start to come on to the meditation, and you're doing your preliminaries here, and then you want to get done with your preliminaries before you peek out, you know what I mean? Because you'd like the peak to happen during your fixed meditation. During the period of deep meditation, you want to be hitting your peak, you know. You don't want the preliminaries to go on in such a way that, you know, you start meditating around here. And then it just gets to be a slow descent into some kind of fogginess by the time you don't, your attention span of even a good meditator is about an hour. You know, don't think, don't believe that stuff about people sitting there 3-4 hours and the tse, or the point at which you have developed giriyam, high tantric realizations, is when you can spend like 3 hours in a deep meditation. So, you know, for us to spend 1 hour would be great. The Sakya masters, Sachen Kunga Nyimbo, Sakya Pandita, Pakpa, they all said 12 minutes for a good meditation. You know, they in Vajrayogini lineage, it's 12-minute sessions. You know, it's about 12 minutes. You concentrate intensely for 12 minutes. Then you break and you walk around, or even you just sit there and you think, and then you go back into a deep meditation. So I think at the beginning, 15 minutes of pure concentrated meditation. Don't be embarrassed. And don't feel stupid if you hear somebody else say, oh, you know, I was at such and such a place and we did 4 hours in a row. It's not true. You can't, okay? You really can't. You can sit there for 4 hours and do a subtle dullness meditation, you know? And you can sit and look good. I mean, if you train yourself, you can look good for 4 hours on the outside. But on the inside, maybe you're not concentrating at all. And I'm afraid that many Americans who can sit for 2 hours still, it's because that during most of that time, they're in a state of subtle dullness, kind of spaced out, and not really focusing very sharply. Peak meditation, any kind of experience that you can have, a movie or a book or any kind of experience where you're totally into something, it normally lasts like 15 minutes. You know what I mean? If you can get 15 intense minutes of meditation, that's very good. You know, then you might want to come out for a while and then go back in for 15 minutes. You know, but at the beginning, don't be embarrassed and be honest with yourself and say, you know, 10 to 15 minutes during that session of really intense meditation on the object. Then come off for a while and then go back in. Okay? So we're going to describe the preliminaries, and then we'll talk about how long it will go on. Maybe it would like be 1 minute per preliminary once you get good at it, okay? And it's not, I meet a lot of Americans who, you know, they do the whole preliminaries for like an hour, and then suddenly they look at the watch and they've got 15 minutes before they have to go to work, and then they rush through their meditation and then they jump up and go to work. It's not like that, okay? You should get good at doing the preliminaries in about 10 to 15 minutes, and then spend the rest of your time where it's supposed to be, which is in deep meditation. And don't succumb either to the extreme of, I'll just do the meditation without the preliminaries. That doesn't work either. Okay, you have to do them, but you have to move through them in a nice, solid way. If you're doing retreat, you know, if you're doing a four-session retreat where you get up at 3:30 or 4 o'clock, you finish your first session by dawn, second session by noon, third session by dusk, fourth session by like 11 p.m. or something. Then you can sit there and spend 45 minutes on your offering and stuff like that. And it's very, very sweet, and you should do that someday. You know, like a four-week meditation, or I know Lama Sopa is planning a three-month meditation this year. That would be great. And then you do your preliminaries, you spend a little more time on it. And that's very, very sweet, okay? But I'm talking normal American. We have to trick you into doing it every day. That's the goal, you know? We have to trick you into spending an hour in deep meditation a day. And if I teach you some kind of preliminaries that take you an hour, 2 weeks from now you won't be doing it, you know? And the danger is that you won't be doing anything else either. You know what I mean? So you have to... You have to try to get to a practice which is concise and which moves quickly and ends before your attention span does. Okay, that's a trick, and you have to do it. It's very important if you can meditate at the same time every day. Okay, same place, same time, same channel every day. Okay, that you get used. That, you know, I worked in this company 15 years. You know, while I was commuting to India, and lunch was at 1 o'clock every day, and it didn't matter where I was. You know, I could be in Thailand or Hong Kong or Tokyo. At 1 o'clock New York time, I would get intensely hungry. You see what I mean? And it should be that way with you, that you're meditating the same time every day. And that at, you know, at 7:30, wherever you are in the world, New York time, you get this intense desire to sit down on your cushion. You know what I mean? And it should be like that. It should be that it becomes part of your body clock that you are doing at the same time. Should you do an evening meditation? I think a light one is okay. If you work an 8-hour day and you come home, don't expect a great meditation. You should do an evening one, a brief one. I find most people find that the morning is when they can do their intense meditation. I have students whose clocks are slightly different, and they do better at 10 o'clock at night or something like that. That's great. If that's the way your body works, that's fine. But do it at the same time every day. I find with most people that morning is better. You know, most people are clearer in the morning. So this is a typical scenario. You get up, and even when you read like the Diamond Cutter Sutra, the Buddha goes and washes his mouth out. You see what I mean? So it's important to have your mouth clean, and that it should taste good. So get up and go brush your teeth first, you know. My lamas taught me that it was very important to have your nose cleaned out. And so you go and you, in the monastery, you turn on the tap, and you, in, you know, 4:30 in the morning, you hear all this, they don't have tissue paper, you know. And I'm not being gross, this is serious. Your nose has to be clear. You should be breathing through your nose and not through your mouth. If you have a bad cold, breathe through your mouth. But your mouth will dry out and it'll be harder to meditate. So it's important to get your nose clear. And you just turn on the water and blow as hard as you can and get everything out. And it's not gross, okay? Even little obstacles here will make your meditation less effective, okay? So even little boogies have to go, all right? And try to get your nose as clear as you can. When you get into the higher practices, Dzogrim, higher stages of Tantra, your body has to be totally healthy and clean. You know, your nose has to be cleared out. Your body has to be trim. It has to be. You have to exercise it a little bit every day. You can't feed it too much. To do the highest practices of Buddhism, this becomes vital that your nose is cleared out and your mind is clear, and that your body is in you know, as good a physical condition as you can do it without vanity, you know, and without you know, like getting hung up on how your body looks. But it should be, you know, tuned, and it's helpful, and you need it to meditate properly. The first of the six preliminaries, you already had the Tibetan, was Jorche Druk. Say Jor. Che. Druk. Jor. Che. Druk. Jor means getting ready to do something. Che means practice, here. And Druk means six. So there's six practices you do to get ready for a meditation. Say Nekang. Chidor. Sorry, Chidar. Che. This is, no, that's right. Is that right? Yeah, okay. Nekang. Chidor. Che. Yeah, that's okay. Nekang means your room, okay? Your room. Chidor means to clean up, sweep up, clean it, okay? Che means do it, all right? One thing to say is that you should dedicate a part of your house or your room or your apartment to your meditation. And it should be spiritually a separate space. You see what I mean? Like it has to be a separate space. Don't try to meditate on your bed. It's got all these sleep vibrations on it. You know what I mean? And that's the last thing you need, okay? So it should be totally different space. Now, people, my students in the East Village are all broke, and they have these tiny little rooms, and, you know, you're not going to have a separate wall or anything like that, but you dedicate a corner of your room to your meditation. It shouldn't be your bed, okay? And it on the ground is very good. It should be on the ground. So it should be like that, in one corner of your room. I have some students who hang a curtain from the ceiling to the ground, and they meditate behind there. I think closets I've found are too small, and they don't work out too good, okay? Then you clean up your room, okay? The first thing you do is after you've finished with the boogies, by the way, have something to drink. You know, all the lamas say, hydrate your body, you know? It's water, weak tea. Coffee is dangerous, but if you need it, okay. Or some kind of juice. But something that your stomach won't have to work on, okay? I think the best, personally, okay, and when you get into meditation, it becomes a personal thing. You know, I mean, what's good for my body might not be good for your body. And you have to experiment. Jetsun Kapa, in the text on meditation, says, look, here's the general instructions, but you have to experiment with your own body. What's the best thing to do? But personally, I find if I haven't eaten for like 12 hours, it's really good. You know, if my stomach is 12 hours empty, it's really, really good. I find that trying to meditate with any kind of food in my stomach is a disaster usually. You know what I mean? It doesn't work. So I think you'll find out that it's not good to meditate with food in your stomach. Okay? Then you go into your room and you straighten it up. The meditation area should be simple, sacred, quiet, clean, attractive. It has all this ambiance of a sweet place. You know, like you've walked into places that have it, and you've walked into other places that don't have it, and you know the difference, you know. That area of your room, okay, at least that area, maybe not the rest, should be somehow very beautiful and sacred space, you know what I mean? And so it should be nice. I think tendency in the West is to collect too much junk, and so it becomes just like a mishmash of stuff on your altar. And, you know, what my Lama does is he has many, many holy objects, many, many, you know, important images, and he rotates them. It's like the Newark Museum does that. You see, you can't have them all up on your altar at the same time. Like, just rotate them in and out. You know what I mean? It also helps make it more fun. You know, like, if you have a particularly nice picture of a Lama, put that for a while, and then pack it up, and then put a different picture for a while, and your altar can be like a constantly evolving thing, and that's fine. Okay, instead of, you know, 20 pictures that you can't see any of them on the altar because there's too many of them or something like that. Okay, it should be beautiful, simple, and it should be dedicated for that purpose. If somebody walks into your room, they say, something important is going on in this corner because it just feels special, you know, something special there. Cleaning also wakes you up, okay? You know, the act of sweeping the entire room, cleaning the pictures, things like that, it gets you moving, okay? And that's important. It's very difficult to go straight from the bed onto the meditation cushion. You need some kind of action going on between those, and it helps you. It helps the meditation, okay? There's another half to the first one. Say kusung tukten dam. Kusung tukten dam. Ku means the holy body of an enlightened being. Okay? What's the holy body of an enlightened being look like? Whatever you want, okay? Whatever they want, okay? Like the Nirmanakaya can appear as a room full of normal Americans, okay? The Sambhogakaya would be the most attractive thing you can think of. So for an American, it might look like, you know, Schwarzenegger or a Playboy bunny or something like that, okay? I mean, they would be something that's very beautiful to you. And in your culture and with your mental seeds, a Buddha would be careful to fit themselves to you. You see what I mean? They would be the most attractive thing that you could imagine. And that's their job. That's what a pneumonicaya does. And your Sambhogakaya will be the sweetest thing you can think of. Or a little bit better than that, actually. Okay? So that's the holy body of a Buddha. Sung means their speech, okay? What they say. And the greatest quality of a Buddha's speech is that no matter what language they speak in, and no matter what they're talking about, it strikes the listener as like the greatest thing that they could be saying at that time, and they always hear it in their own language. Okay, so a Buddha can stand up there and speak Sanskrit, and everybody hears their own language. That's one of the best. In other words, Buddhas are very good at relating to normal people. Okay, Thuk means their mind. Okay, a Buddha's enlightened mind. The ability to see every single object in the universe at the same time, period. Past, present, and future. They see everything in the universe in the same moment. Okay. Den means a location for them. Okay. And Kusung Tukden is the Tibetan word for an altar. Okay. Location for the body, speech, and mind of an enlightened being. So this would be called a Kusung Tukden. Okay. Up here. This would be a Kusung Tukden. Alright? Dham means set it up. Okay? Dham means set it up. So the first of the preliminaries is actually two things. Clean up your sacred space and set up an altar. Okay? Set up an altar. I think it's very important to say that this is not a Buddha, okay? I mean, people, I hope it doesn't happen in America, but you know, if you had a choice between an altar or Lama Supa sitting there, I mean, you have to realize that one is a Buddha and one is not, you know what I mean? It's just a picture, it's just an image, okay? And it's a lousy image, to tell you the truth, you know what I mean? The real thing is much, much more powerful. And I think you have to be careful not to request and not to worship a picture or an image. It's not the real thing, okay? I mean, it has importance, and it's a great thing that we have it there, but that's not the real thing, okay? When you visualize a Buddha, which is going to come later, for God's sake, don't visualize a tanka, okay? Got the difference? I'm afraid that most people are visualizing the last tanka they saw, you know, the last painting they saw of a Buddha, or they're visualizing a statue with a big belly or something, you know what I mean? It's not like that. This is just a representation of a thing which is much more amazing, right? And it's important to have one. It's important to have an altar. But Jetsun Kapa in his text, he warns you, he says, don't sit there. He says it was popular in some parts of China maybe or India to sit in front of a Buddha picture and stare at it. And they thought that was a good meditation. He said, no. Meditation is yiki namshe. Say yiki namshe. Yiki namshe. Yiki namshe means visualization is always a mental consciousness. Your other sense consciousness are shut down. Okay, the idea that you would sit in front of a picture and stare at it, and that's meditation, does not help you perceive emptiness. You see what I mean? You have to get to where you have gone out of your body. You've withdrawn from all your senses, and real meditation takes place in the mind, not in the eyeball. You know, I've had people say to me, I say, what are you meditating on? They say, I stare at a lamp, you know, and I try to see it. Or Jetsun Kapa was very critical of the idea that you should... People read in the scripture that emptiness is like a mirror, you know? Like, if you understand how a mirror works, you understand how emptiness works. And so all these people went out and bought mirrors and would stare at mirrors, you know? And he said, come on, you don't get it at all. You know, it's a metaphor, you know what I mean? So it's not done with your eyeballs, okay? Even the path of seeing, right, means to see with your mind, okay? Not to see with your eyeballs, all right? So... it's very important to have an altar. It's very important to have your pictures of your lamas and the Buddha, representation of the Buddha's body. Like if you have Lama Sopa's picture here, you have a representation of the Buddha's body. Then you put a scripture here. some kind of scripture. Okay, my students, we put out these CD-ROMs with thousands of Tibetan books on them, and that's really a cheap 60 cents, okay? You can have all the Buddhist scriptures on your altar, you know. This is a cool way to do it. Or, and then for tuk, for the mind, normally they put a little stupa. If you saw when we did the mandala this morning, the last thing they offered was a stupa. And it represents the Buddha's mind, okay? And that's all. And you set up an altar, but it doesn't mean this is the Buddha, okay? The Buddha does come into your room while you're meditating. But where all that are they? They say in the scripture very clearly, all the Buddhas in the universe can fit on the tip of a pin. Okay? All the Buddhas in the universe can fit on the tip of a pin. Okay? And you go through this big deal of inviting them to come. They're omniscient. They knew a million years ago you were going to ask them to come. It's not like they were waiting, you know what I mean? And they do appear. You know, they're already there. But you go through this process of asking anyway. Not for their benefit, for your benefit, okay? Because it's good to ask, okay? So that's a setting up your altar. I think there's two extremes with altars. You know, some people think that's the Buddha, which is one extreme. And they get into altar worship, you know what I mean? And then the Lama comes and they're like, yeah, who are you, you know? You don't have this stuff, you know? And that's a big mistake. And then I think the other extreme is people who say, I don't need those images. I'm just, my mind is my temple, you know. And then they don't have any images of holy beings on their. And I think that's another mistake, you know. You should have pictures of your sweet, holy, wonderful, sexy lamas. And you should look at them from time to time and say, thank you, and I love you, and, you know, like that. And it's very good to have them, okay, like that. Say chupa, sham. Chupa, sham. Chupa means offerings. Okay. Sham means put them out on your altar. You know, put them there. This is a very specific practice. At the minimum, you know, have ready a small flower. A little hostess Twinkie, you know, just some kind of little thing like, I'm offering this to you in the morning, you know, a piece of fruit or something. You know, you have to get it the night before, right? You get it the day before, and you have it ready in your refrigerator, and then when you set up your altar and when you cleaned everything, you have that ready. By the way, if you're cleaning every morning, the size of a meditation area in the East Village in New York, it don't take too long, because it's about 2 square feet, you know. So it's not like you spend an hour cleaning the room. You just straighten it up slightly. The point is not to clean it's not to get the dust off things. It's the spiritual exercise of cleaning. You know what I mean? And they say that as you clean, you're supposed to think that you're cleaning your mind. Okay? So while you're cleaning things, you're thinking, I'm cleaning my mind. And if you get into it, you'll see how that little space gets cleaner and cleaner and cleaner. You know? And finally, you're dealing with little tiny dust particles. And this represents it's symbolic of the cleaning of your mind. You know, first you get all the first day you get all the main garbage out. And then it becomes cleaner and cleaner and cleaner. And finally, it's just light maintenance, right? You're just touching up with a feather duster or something. And that represents how you clean your mind, okay? With offering, the Buddhas don't come and, it's not like Santa Claus coming and eating the cookies and drinking the milk, okay? We used to be really disappointed. We'd wake up, we'd sneak out before my parents had time to clean it up, and it would still be there, and the presents were there already, so we knew something was going on, you know? And it's not like they come and they eat the stuff and they drink the stuff. Buddhas don't need anything to eat. They don't eat food. They have other kinds of sustenance. So it's not like you're putting it out for them. It's for you, okay? It's the act of putting out something beautiful and thinking that you're inviting them into your room, okay? So you put out some kind of beautiful offerings. Make it fresh, change it all. Flowers are really, really good. Flowers also have some significance in Tantra about the chakras. So it's also very auspicious to put out some flowers, okay? Um, in Tibet, there became a custom of putting out water bowls. Okay, and these are little cups or little bowls that you can use. Okay, I'll tell you a little bit about what they mean. Okay, normally it's a 7 or 8. The first one is normally, we're talking to your left, okay? As you face the altar, you start from your left, and you start laying out these bowls, okay? Normally you stack them all together. You pour some water in the top one, and then you take the top one out, and you pour most of the water into the second one, and you set that one down on the left, your left, as you're facing the altar. And then you take the second one and you pour most of the water into the third one and set that out. You don't set them all out and then pour water into them. And this represents the passing on of knowledge through the lineage, okay? Of the turning of the wheel, meaning teacher to student who becomes the teacher for the next generation, okay? So like, I'm teaching you today, in a year or 2 years or 3 years, you'll be teaching your own students. And then the idea is that the lineage goes on like that. The water is poured from person to person. And you don't own the water. You're just a receptacle for it. You know what I mean? People tend to start to think of themselves as owning the water. And that's not the idea. You are just passing it on to the next generation. You know, you're just a vehicle or a vessel. And you're supposed to think of that when you set out your water bowls. Why do they use water? It's because it's so cheap. And it's supposed to be a really bad deed to offer more than you are capable. Like if you offer something that's very expensive, and then 2 hours later you start to question yourself, maybe I shouldn't have spent that much money. It's supposed to be really special kind of bad karma. So they say if you offer water, then probably you're not going to regret it like 2 hours later. You know, like I really wanted that glass of water myself. You know what I mean? So the idea is something so cheap and so common that you won't get attached to it, you know, and you won't collect that special bad karma of regretting it later. This also applies to making offerings. You know, you should give what you can, but you shouldn't give so much that at some point you regret it. Master Shantideva said, start out by offering potatoes, okay? He said, you know, start out with carrots and potatoes and stuff like that. Start off with small things and then build up to your proper level. But I've seen many American Buddhists, they go to their first few classes, they get all excited, they go out and sell their house, they offer the money to the Lama. If the Lama's smart, they say, no, you keep it for 6 months. If you still feel that way, give it to me, you know? And then they regret it after 2 weeks. You see what I mean? So it's very important not to go through that cycle. That's why water is good, okay? Then as you set down the first, when you're done and all the bowls are laid out with a little bit of water in each one, then you go back and you start filling them up from the left, from your left as you face the altar, okay? And in the first, as you fill the first bowl, you think of, we call argam. Argam means the purpose of the first bowl is drinking water. This is offering something to drink to the lamas and to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, okay? And in your mind, you're offering something to drink, okay? You can also put a little bit of saffron in the water, and it's nice. Normally, you'd have to put it in the night before, in the pitcher, and it gets to a very sweet color. This is in India. This is common for making the water smell good. Okay, so the first bowl represents drinking water. The idea is that if a guest came to your house in ancient India, the first thing you'd do is to offer them something to drink. Okay, and the image is of a great king coming to your lousy little apartment. And you're offering them things one by one. That's the image of the water bowls. Okay, so the first one means you're offering them something to drink. As you fill up the second one, you think of bathing their feet. Okay, and this is like in the Middle East, like Jesus was always doing that. People wear sandals. If you've been in India, you know, your feet are really filthy by the time you've walked down the street. All sorts of weird stuff on the street. And the idea is that you're offering to wash their feet for them, okay? In Sanskrit, it's called bating. And if you do the mudra, it's argam, bating. And then next one is called pube or flower, okay? And you make an offering of flower. Here you have an option. You can either pour water in a bowl, or you can fill up the bowl with rice. and put a fresh flour there. You know, cut a fresh flour and set it right there on the rice. So you can do it either way. You can imagine that the water represents a flour, or you can actually put a flour there. And rice is very nice for holding them. So if you get a rose and you want to stick it up, then the rice works very well. So it's arga, badi, bubi. The fourth one is dube, which means incense. Okay, and the custom is to put two incense sticks side by side, sticking up out of a bowl of rice. So you fill it up with rice, you top it off like that, or you can pack it up a little bit, and then you put two, and you can spend 20 minutes trying to get them straight. Okay? Okay. It's a custom, if you do the rice thing, that you don't change it every day. You need to change the water every day. But if you put rice and some incense, you can leave that there for a while. By the way, that's the fourth bowl, and that's the center bowl, so you can kind of work off of that. You know, if you want to get it centered nicely, that's the center bowl, okay? Normally, you're offering seven bowls, sometimes eight. Dube. Next one is dipe. Is that right? Yeah. Dipe or alake, depending on which tantra you're in, okay? That represents a light, okay? Like a butter lamp is good, okay? You can put a candle in there and light it. Normally, they would put a butter lamp in there, you know, a little thing. And then somebody has to teach you how to do that. If you're interested, some of the people in New York do it all the time. So, you know, you clarify the butter. You make a wick out of a small piece of flour or something and some cotton. And it's really cool to make them, and then they burn really nice. They can burn for like 12, 15 hours, and they're really nice. So you put the next one. And it represents offering to the king's senses. You know, you're offering to the sense of sight, sound, smell, taste, and you're offering all these things to the senses. So alake. And then gende. Gende means offering perfume water. Okay, and this is where you're like, wouldn't you like some perfume, you know? And you put some perfume on their body, okay, perfume water. Here you can use, another water bowl. Okay, so far you have two water bowls, and then you have a bowl with a flower in it, and then you have incense, and then you have a bowl with a lamp, and now you have another bowl with water in it, okay? Last one is gandhi, and then nudi means something to eat, okay? And normally we put rice, fill up the bowl, top it off, and put some kind of, they stack up three cookies sometimes or something like that. That's traditional, okay? White is better than dark, okay? Like white is supposed to mean purity of your mind or something like that. So I guess Oreos would be 50-50. My Lama is very particular. He'll drag me through the grocery store for hours looking for sugar cookies that are the right color with white speckles on them, and they can't be chipped or broken. He throws them out. He'll go through a whole package and get three cookies, you know, and they're stacked just right and like that. So it's considered auspicious if they're white. Again, you can just do seven water bowls, and that's okay. That's all right. There's an eighth one which you can do. It's optional. Shabda, which means music, okay? You could put a Neil Young tape on the altar. Very good. You know, stuff like that. And don't be shy, you know. Don't think the Tibetans didn't change things a little bit when Buddhism got to Tibet. I tell people this story, it's true. We have a computer project going in the Russian Academy of Sciences. They have 200,000 Tibetan books. We're cataloging them. It'll take 25 years. We finished a quarter of them, 7 years. And next door is the Hermitage Museum. And they took me in there and they said, we want you to see this, what do you call it when they make a fresco? There's a fresco that they ripped off from Karakatum or something like that. And this was before Buddhism reached Tibet, well before Buddhism reached Tibet. And it's Vajrapani. And he looks just like an American. His face is very, very much Western. He doesn't look Chinese or Tibetan. And they were drawn in Gandharvian, you know, the faces were not Oriental at all. That was after they got to Tibet and China. So, you know, you don't have to think it's funny to offer Neil Young or something like that. You know, that's it's what's beautiful in your culture you have to use. And eventually I think the sacred art will start to take on that. And that's fine. Why? Because they appear in any way that helps you. And if you find that most attractive, then it's not like Tara can't appear as an American woman if she wanted to. You see what I mean? That's her shtick. That's what she does. She's supposed to do that. If she shows up in some form that you can't appreciate or you can't relate to, she has failed in her sacred mission. You see what I mean? And she will. So don't be embarrassed or shy to think, you know, they will be Western, and that's what they do. Okay? And you finish out and you put out these offerings like that. Okay? At the end of the day, when you take them up, you start from the back and you dump them out and you turn them over and you stack them on each other like that. They're depending on each other like that. And the idea is that every night before you go to bed, the last thing you do is you pour out your offerings. And the Kadampas used to do this, the first Tibetan Buddhists used to do this to symbolize that they were wrapping up their life and they're ready to die in their sleep tonight. It means if someone came into my room tomorrow and they found this corpse in the bed, everything was already done. You know, the water bowls have been emptied, okay, you know. Okay, the next owner can have them and they'll be all dry. Okay, and that's the idea of the water bowls, okay? And that's the offering. There'll be later in the seven limbs another offering, but that one's done in your mind, okay? That one's done after you're already in meditation, okay? This one we're talking about before you sit down. You haven't sat down yet, right? Okay? Say nam nang chedun. Nam nang chedun. Again, we had this already this morning. Nam nang is vayochana, okay? Chedun means the seven details of that posture. So here, finally, you're sitting down. Okay, this is to sit down on your meditation cushion, and you go into meditation with seven different aspects or seven different details in your posture. We're not going to do that today. We'll do it in a later class. You know, because it takes a long time to go through it carefully. Okay, but this is the proper way of sitting. Okay. Proper way means there's a certain way of sitting that if you can do it, it has an effect on your channels, on your inner spiritual body. You have an inner body that you can't see right now. If you did an operation and you opened up your tummy, you wouldn't find anything, okay? But there's a very, very subtle physical form that you have, which is inside of your body, and if you are in a certain arrangement, if your body is arranged in a certain way, it's very good for the flow of energy throughout your body. So that's called the seven-point meditation posture, of Vayochana. Say uk dang. Uk dang. Okay. Uk means your breath, okay? Your breath. Dung means counter breaths. Alright? This is a practice that's very old. It was taught by Master Vastubandhu in 350 AD in the Abhidhamma Kosha. And it's a practice of counting your breaths. Okay? We can practice it tomorrow morning. It's very bad to practice it with a full tummy and a hot day in the afternoon when you didn't get any sleep the night before. Tonight I'm sure you're going to get a lot of sleep. And we'll do it in the morning, okay? But this is where you watch your breath and you count it, okay? The custom here is to do it 10 times. You're counting 10 breaths. I'll go into that just a touch. By the way, this is still part of number 3, okay? Sometimes they say 8 meditation points, 8 posture points, and breath is number 8, okay? It's additional on top of the normal 7. I'll give you a little bit about how to watch your breath. First thing to know is that the out-breath is the first half and the in-breath is the second half, okay? In America, they say, count your breaths. You go, in-out is one. And in Buddhism, it's reversed. It has a very, very important significance in the practice of Tantra, okay? Everything in Tantra, in certain practices, is supposed to be coming in towards the center and not dissipating out. So it's important that when you count a breath, the first half of the breath is out, and the second half of the breath is coming in. Okay, so when you count your breaths, half out, second half in, that counts as one. Okay? How do you watch your breath? I mean, you could really mess up your eyes trying to stare at your nose, try to watch your breath. It's not really watching. It's actually staying aware of the feel of the breath on the inside of your nostrils, right here, okay? As the colder air hits your nose, right on the inside of the opening here, and you feel it, you're supposed to put your mind... I always think of the gates of Hercules in the Mediterranean Ocean, and here's Spain, and here's Africa, you're watching the ships come in and out, you see what I mean? So you're supposed to focus your mind like two little guys sitting here. It's like two donuts, really, okay? And you're focusing your mind right there. And it's not, I'm not joking. You focus your mind on a pinpoint right here, and you feel. Watching the breath means feeling the breath hit this part of your nose on each side, and then the warmer breath coming out. So really, you're just parked. You're sitting on a chair right here, and you're feeling the breath hit the nose right here, or the cells of the skin right here, and then hitting out, okay? And that's what it means to watch your breath, okay? You can't watch the whole thing. It's very distracting, Try to feel all the feel of the breath going down and then coming out and going out like 3 feet, and it can be very distracting. Park your mind single-pointedly. Ding in zin. Say chik tu number shakpa. Right here. And concentrate on the touch of the breath. So that means you can have your eyes open or your eyes closed. Doesn't matter. You're still watching the breath, meaning you're feeling your nose, okay? The feel of the breath on your nose, okay? And then you very subtly, you watch it come in and out. It's very important at this stage that you don't try to control the breath, okay? Let it flow naturally. If you try to hold your breath somehow or retain your breath or something like that, it will mess you up. If you're doing longer meditation, you'll get a condition called lung. Lung means air, and it refers to the inner airs. When you concentrate too hard, when you try to hold your breath too much, when you meditate too long without taking a break, when you get upset at another person, you start to breathe faster, you start to breathe shallow breaths, and if it gets really bad, you start to feel a pain here, or you feel like you can't breathe. If it gets worse, you can't sleep. Okay, and then that's a very bad... If it gets worse, you go nutty and you run around with your clothes off, okay? And there was a woman at the library in Tibet, Tibetan library I was, who set herself on fire, after that. So, you have to be careful. There's a whole range of this problem, you see? And it starts by not taking care of your breath properly, okay? So the breath is very important in the practice. You have to be very happy and very relaxed and just let your breath do its thing. Don't try to dictate how the breath goes in and how the breath goes out. At the beginning, as a preliminary, you're just relaxing and watching your breath go in and out, okay? The idea is to get to 10 without getting distracted, all right? This is a very cool exercise. I remember the first few months that I tried it, I never got past 3. And this is like an honesty test. Can you catch yourself thinking about something else before you get to 10? And if you're really good at it, probably you won't get to 10 for a long time. Okay? My lamas told me, look, if you keep getting to 3 like 20, 30 times, and it gets to be an hour and a half later, go ahead, keep going. Okay, so don't spend an hour on this, okay? Try to get to 10 if you can. You'll find yourself spacing out and going to 14 sometimes, okay? That happens a lot too. If you get to 50, try to stop, okay? But this is the exercise of, can you take 10 breaths without thinking of something else and without being distracted? Now, in New York City, I always tell people, it doesn't count if you hear a car horn, okay? If someone slams a door and you stop, that's not really fair. What it means is you can be aware of a distraction and you come right back. You can't help it if somebody honks a car horn in front of your window. Your mind's going to go there, but if it comes right back, you can still count. If it comes back before 3.5, you know, between 3 and 3.5, it's okay. You don't have to start over again. Okay, that's like an act of God, right? It doesn't count. Okay, so you don't have to worry about that. But what it means is if you get distracted and you start, it's not that you just think about what you're going to have for breakfast, but you actually, in your mind, you go to the refrigerator, open it up, looking how many donuts there are, you know, then you have to start over again, okay? And you, the point is to get your mind settled down. And this is like, I compare it to going from, you know how you back your car out of the garage, and then you stop, and then you put it in drive and you go, you know what I mean? But nobody goes from reverse to drive immediately, you know what I mean, while the car's still moving. It strips the gears, you know, you hear this, and in meditation it's very important to do the same thing. The goal is to put your mind into neutral, okay? It has become a practice now for people to spend their whole life meditating on their breath. This is not the point. This is not what Vasubandhu wanted. You can read the original, I can show you the original. He just wanted you to do it 10 breaths, maybe 2 times, maybe 3 times, then for God's sake, get on to your meditation, okay? Watching the breath is not a goal, you know what I mean? People watch their breath all the time. It doesn't get you enlightened, okay? It was meant as an exercise to put your mind into neutral. And then you move your mind to an important object like emptiness or a Buddha image or thinking about compassion or something like that. But just to sit your whole career, your meditation career, and watch your breath, the breath is not an innately virtuous object. It's just a neutral object. And the point is to just get your mind into a meditative mood. It's not to sit there and watch your breath for an hour. Okay? In the higher tantric practices, there are different kinds of breathing exercises and different kinds of breath. And I'm not talking about that. That's a holy thing, and you can spend your whole life on that. And that would be good. But not just counting your breath your whole life. That's not a goal, okay? It's just to get your mind into neutral. That's the purpose of Ukdrum. There's going to be 4 different parts to this number 3. A, B, C. Say, Kyamdo. Kyamdo. Going for refuge, okay? Kyab means refuge, Dro means to go. I think the first time I came out here to you guys' center, we did 5 days of what it means to go for refuge, or something like that. You know what I mean? This is a long story. It's a very, very important spiritual exercise, and I can't go into it in a whole lot of detail, but if you want to do a short Kyamdo, the ultimate Kyamdo is emptiness, okay? The ultimate protection is to understand emptiness, okay? Can this Buddha statue protect you? No. Prove it. 1 million Tibetans killed in front of their altars by soldiers, you know what I mean? Apparently, it doesn't, you know, just to sit near an altar or be near an altar, it's not going to save you. That's not refuge, okay? You're not taking refuge in a picture or an image like that. It can't help you. Well, even Lord Buddha, when he was alive in this world, he was the Shakyamuni, right? Shakyamuni means head of the Shakyas. Their village was attacked by soldiers from the nearby clan, you know. People ran into his room. People grabbed his clothing and begged him to help them. And they were slaughtered on the spot, touching him, holding on to him. They were killed. It can't protect you that way, okay? An enlightened being cannot protect you from your own karma. Cannot do it, okay? All they can do is teach you how to do it yourself, okay? So when you think about refuge, I hope American Buddhism never gets into some blind thing where you're going, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Sangha, and you're looking at some image, you know, you're looking at some statue as if it's going to protect you. It cannot. Even if Lord Buddha was sitting there, he couldn't help you, okay? The protection is your own knowledge and your own understanding of compassion and emptiness. That's the only thing that can protect you, okay? And we talked about it in some detail last night. But ultimately, you have to do a 2-minute refuge, act of refuge. You know, at this point in your meditation, you're already sitting on your seat. you're already in meditation. You have to do like a 2-minute act of refuge. I'll describe a 2-minute act of refuge, okay? I'm having trouble with such and such a person at my office. Okay? I will probably meet them today. They will probably say something to me that I don't like. And what am I going to do when they do that? I'm going to think like this, you know. They don't have any nature of their own. They are empty. Their words don't have any nature of their own. They are empty. If I was in a pure state of mind, if I had good karma, I would be hearing my holy lama singing to me Milarepa songs. You know what I mean? And because my mind's not clear, I have to hear my friend or my workmate saying something unpleasant to me at my office. But the reason I'm hearing something bad is my own bad karma. Okay? And if my karma was good, and if my mind was pure, I would hear those same words as something very sweet and holy. Okay? So, when they yell at me today, because my mind's not pure yet, I'm going to remember that, and I won't yell back at them. Okay? And if I don't yell back at them, as Master Shantideva said, they'll go away. Okay? And this is very exciting to watch in real life, you know? You have somebody in your office who irritates you, and you continue to take refuge, you see? And the minute they say something bad to you, you're like, Jimin Yambe Sopa means, yeah, whatever you say, you know? I don't mind. Yeah, I probably am a stupid, you know, guy who can't do anything. You know, it's okay. I don't mind, you know? And if you keep this up, after a while, that karma wears out, and there ain't no new bad karma. So what happens? This person gets transferred. This person has a heart attack. You know, something like that, okay? I'm not kidding. It's really amazing to watch. You know, you can purify your office. You can eliminate all of these people, okay? And you don't need a gun, okay? I mean, just patience, just love. And slowly, that office is transformed. If you're really practicing well, and this is not, I'm sorry, if this is not happening to you, you're not practicing properly, okay? Buddhist practice means this should be going on, okay? If this is not happening in your life, you ain't practicing right. Something's wrong, okay? Slowly, all the, I almost used a bad word, but my lama said I shouldn't do it anymore. All the people who irritate you in the office will start to disappear, honestly. And if that process is not going on in a fairly steady way, your practice ain't going too well, okay? And this all comes from remembering their emptiness, okay? That's an act of refuge. What I just described is an act of refuge. Why? You just saved your rear end from going to a hell realm. That's protection, okay? The Buddha cannot hug you and protect you. The Buddha can't... The first Dalai Lama, in his Abhidharma Kosha, he says... The Buddha can't come and pour water on your head and suddenly all your sins are gone. You know, the Buddha can't come and, you know, touch you and everything's okay. All they can do is teach you how to do an act of protection yourself. And that's an act of protection. And you say, oh, that's not cosmic enough. You know, I was working with all sentient beings, you know. This is all sentient beings for you. They're the people in your office. It's the people in your family. It's your husband or your kids. You know what I mean? This is, you can't relate to all sentient beings. They are representing all sentient beings for you. And at that moment, if you refuse to respond negatively, you have just protected your rear end from a lot of bad karma. And that's an act of refuge, okay? What does that mean when you're about to go into meditation? Personally, I think about the person I'm going to meet today that caused me the most trouble. And I do an act of refuge. I do role play in my mind. You know, I say, okay, what am I going to do when they say blah, blah, blah? And then I get ready, you know, and I go through it once or twice. And that is an act of refuge, okay? That's an example of an act of refuge. You will meet them later in the day, and they will come up with some new way to irritate you that you weren't ready for. And then the next day you can do a different act of refuge, okay? That's an act of refuge. And that's the only thing that can protect you. Ultimately, you have to understand the emptiness of what's going on there. And that's the ultimate protection. what's a Buddha jewel as opposed to the Buddha? What's the difference between Buddha jewel, the refuge, and the Buddha? Buddha jewel is the emptiness of the Buddha's mind and body, the Dhammakaya. What's the Dharma jewel as opposed to the Dharma? It's the direct perception of emptiness that saves your rear end. What's the Buddha? What's the Sangha jewel as opposed to the Sangha? It's that group of people who have seen emptiness directly. Are we seeing a theme here? Okay, I mean, emptiness of the Buddha's body and mind, direct perception of emptiness, and all the people who have ever done that. That is the three jewels, okay? And that's who can protect you. And that's an act of protection. It's not, please, you know, bowing down to some statue, you know, that can't protect you. Even if Lord Buddha was here, he can't help you, okay? Like that. That's that old Judeo-Christian thing. It doesn't work. It really doesn't work at all. So give it up, okay? D. We'll do Senkei and then we'll take a break, okay? It's S-E-M-K-Y-E, okay? Senkei. Say Senkei.
Senkei.
The Sanskrit is bodhicitta, okay? Bodhicitta. Bodhicitta can be a very, very simple thing, very similar to taking refuge, okay? If I go back to my office, if later, by the way, I did this for 16 years in corporate life. I know what it is, you know what I mean? And don't think that you can work in a company of 1,000 people and not meet some people that you have trouble with, okay? That's two times I avoided that word. Okay. If I had gone to the office that afternoon, and if they had come into my room and said that unkind thing to me that irritates me, almost used another word, and if I didn't respond, I have done an act of refuge. That's an act of refuge. I have just prevented Michael Roach from suffering a lot later on. Okay, I just turned off the faucet of some suffering for him later. Okay, but then look around the room. Okay. Look around the room where you are, and people are bickering with each other, people are backstabbing each other, people are having these weird thoughts. You know, we worked really hard. Our company doubled every year for 15 years. We worked like maniacs, but every once in a while there wouldn't be enough work, and then people start getting on each other's case. When you're really busy, you don't have time to hate everybody around you, but when things are slow and you're wondering if you're going to be in the next layoff, you know, then everybody starts bickering with each other, you know? And then you watch people. The boss comes in, he says something to them, and then they say something back, you know? They've just done the opposite of an act of refuge. They've just done an act of samsara, okay? Samsara means self-perpetuating circle of suffering. That guy yells at you, you get angry, you yell back. What's the only karma that can create a yelling boss? Yelling at them, okay? If you want to assure beyond a shadow of a doubt that you will see this guy again and again and again in that same mode, the very best way, and in fact, according to Buddhism, the only way is to yell back at them. And what's the normal human thing? I mean, the normal thing is to yell back at them. So, in essence, you're shooting your toes or something, you know? It's ironic, I don't know how we got there, but you are doing the only thing that will guarantee that they will come back again. And it's this cycle like that. So look around the room. I used to work in a room with 30 people staring at 30,000 diamonds a day. You know, you're supposed to pick them up with these tweezers, you know, and you go, you know, and you sort like 10,000 of them in a day, you know. And they're all like under pressure. And then you see them getting angry with each other, having these interactions. And then you're aware that it's just like watching kids play with razor blades. You know, like if you had a group of little kids, you know, like two-year-olds, and you threw a bunch of razor blades in there and said, play with these, you know. And they're like cutting themselves up and bleeding all over the place. I mean, a normal office, if you're a Buddhist, and if you understand the karmic scene that's going down there, it's just like watching kids play with razor blades. It's as pitiful, it's as sad, it's as violent as kids playing with razor blades. That's Senkei, Okay? That's an act of bodhicitta. You don't have to think about the welfare of all sentient beings, including Pluto and Mars and Neptune. You can see it right in your own office, you know, and you can get that same feeling of watching a bunch of kids play with razor blades. That's Senke. Okay, so just do it for a minute or two in your preliminary, okay, and you dedicate the meditation to helping them. You know, someday may I be able to talk to them or teach them or some way affect them that they would stop cutting themselves up, okay? And that's real Semke, okay? That's a real act of Semke, bodhicitta. And that's the end of the third preliminary. We'll take a break there, and then we'll finish the rest of them, okay? What's that? Might wake them up. Say, Tsokshing. Sound up. Tsokshing. Sound up. Tsokshing means the assembly of all the lineage lamas. It's like if you're studying. I know some of you are doing the six practices on Naropa. This is like 32 lineage lamas, plus Lama Yeshin, Lama Sipa, you know, and then, you know, 37 different bodhisattvas and Buddhas and all the listeners and all the self-made Buddhas, and Shravakas and Pratyekas and all, you know, the four guardians of the directions. And then it gets, this is called Tsokshing, okay? Shing means a garden. Or a field where you plant your good deeds. So this is a code word for your lama, okay? Tsokshing, lineage field, okay? Sound depth means to visualize them. If you do this carefully, it will take you about 3 days, okay? You will never get to your meditation. You can either do a real dim one and feel guilty all day, but there's a nice cop-out called Kundu. Say Kundu. Norbu. Loop. Kundu. Norbu. Loop. Kundu Norbu Loop means just visualize your own sweet root lama. Okay? And they represent all the other people. Okay? And personally, for 25 years, that's all I ever did. Okay? And it's fine. It's not anything less than all the lamas in the universe. Okay? In fact, all the scriptures say that this person, since they are the only window between you and the enlightened realm right now, are more important than all those other guys to you. This one person who's in your own life, who's your connection to the enlightened lineage, you know. So this one person who's alive now is more important than all the others, and that's no contradiction. They represent for you, functionally, all the Buddhas of the universe. So it's fine to... You know, personally, if I've got to go to work in 45... We already spent about 12 minutes, right? I got to go to work in like an hour and 18 minutes or something. I do a Kundu Norbu Loop. And it's even in the highest tantras, this is accepted as a very wonderful system, okay? And you visualize in front of you your root lama, okay? Somebody meditating with you, okay? Again, please don't visualize a tanka. And don't visualize a picture. Okay? Start with the outline. This is the way it goes, okay? Start with the outline of this person, okay? Man or woman, doesn't matter. Ordained, not ordained, doesn't matter. The person that you relate to as a lama. And you see them as if there's a light shining behind them, and you see this out. You start with the, when you do the visualization, you start with the outline. And then you start filling in the eyes, and then fill in the rest of the face, and then fill in the colors of the hair, and if they have any, and and then fill in the rest, okay? And this is how to do this visualization, okay? Then start, I mean, don't leave them a two-dimensional, the poor flat guy, you know? Don't leave them two-dimensional. Make them breathing. Make them blinking. Give their body a nice scent. You see what I mean? Feel their breath on your face. You know what I mean? Make them warm. Feel their warmth on you. You know, make them live. You have to get to a point where you actually could, in your mind's eye, right? You're not opening your eyes. You could visualize this being in front of you who's breathing, happy, smiling, has their own emotions, you know, bright, everything. Like you could reach out and touch them. Okay, and this is the way to visualize your lama. Okay, so that's very important too. This is the step where you visualize your lama in front of you. Okay. If you don't have a lama, invent some perfect being. Okay, if you do have a lama, and you don't see them as a perfect being at this point in your meditation, clean them up. Physically and mentally, you know, give them hair everywhere, you know, make them never angry, never jealous, totally healthy. They say 16 years old, you know, strong, vital, beautiful, warm, you know, perfect mentally and physically. It's not naivety, you know. And you don't even have to buy that thing about they really are that way, but you can't see it, which is true, but you don't have to buy it right now. Just pretend that they're perfect and visualize them that way. No use to pretend some guy who gets jealous every 5 minutes or something like that. You know, in this visualization, make them perfect, okay? And it's just sweet to get used to being around a perfect person, even if you haven't bumped into them yet, okay? It's just sweet to imagine what would it be like to be meditating in a room alone with a perfect person, okay? And just the exercise of trying to imagine a physically and mentally perfect being is very much, it's a lot of fun. And it makes you feel great, and that's the whole point, okay? I used to feel like I was grudgingly admitting that my lama was perfect, you know, like there was some kind of resistance to thinking of them as perfect. You know, I was like, yeah, but yesterday he yelled at me, he can't be perfect, you know, I'm perfect. But I, you know what I mean? But give that up. Let that go. It's not that you are like saying, oh, you're perfect, you're my God, or something like that. It's not like that. It's just that it's a very healthy exercise to imagine a physically, mentally, spiritually perfect being sitting there and meditating with you. Okay? And they say, imagine that this person is madly in love with you spiritually. Okay? They would do anything for you. When they heard that you wanted them to come and sit in front of you and meditate with you, they were like, oh man, finally they asked me. And they're filled with joy and their light, their face is just beaming at you, happy with you. They're saying, finally, after a zillion eons, you know, you sat down to meditate. You're so great, you know, and they're like happy. And you got to feel this energy coming from them of joy. Okay, that's supposed to be a big part of the visualization. Okay, it's not like they're this cold, boring tanka. Okay? Not like that. Nichidharmabhadra, one of the greatest lamas of our Vajrayogini lineage, and a former life of Baboka Rinpoche, said, please don't visualize everything as tankas, you know? It's boring. You know, any normal, intelligent person would get bored after 20 minutes of that. You know, he says, don't do that. Make it, liven it up, you know? Make them cool, make them interesting, make them beautiful. You know what I mean? He was very adamant about that. We have that in one of his teachings, okay? Say, Dibjang Soksat. Dibjang Soksat. Dib means spiritual obstacles. It also means shadow, for example. Okay, like a shadow over your life. You know, a shadow on you. Jip means that. Jang means to clean them out, get rid of them. Okay, this is the Jang in Jang Jup, which means Buddha. Okay, Sok means incredibly strong, good karma. Okay, big pile of good karma. It's the same Sok that means an assembly, right? And Sak means to Tsoka Sok. You know, it means to collect together a big bag of good karma. Okay? Sok Sart. This is where you undertake some practices to just before you go into meditation. This is maybe the most important one. Just before you go into meditation, you do some very powerful practices to take a shot at your bad karma store, your bad karma pocket, you know, your big purse full of old bad karmas. And you do some very powerful attempt just before you go into meditation to try to lower that energy. You know, you try to dissipate the energy of your old bad karma, all your spiritual obstacles. And then Sok Sak means just before you go into meditation, you do some very powerful good deeds. Okay? Like last minute, just before you go into meditation, get rid of some bad karma, collect some very powerful good karma. If you notice, like after a very good teaching, like if you have a very, very good teaching, you go out in your car, you turn on the radio, it's always some really great song, you know? And then that wears off in about half an hour, you know what I mean? And there's this energy that you can have if you do a very, very good deed, like you visit someone at the hospital that you didn't like so much and they're very sick. Just coming out of the door, on the way home, you have this energy. You have this really good energy. And then it starts to wear off because you meet your husband or your wife or whatever, you know, stuff like that. But for like half an hour, there's this incredible energy. So the idea is just before you go into meditation, you do some big, powerful purification and some powerful good karma. The best way to do that is with what we call the seven limbs or the seven ingredients, okay? Limbs is a bad translation of yenlak that means a component or the ingredients of a recipe, okay? So there's seven steps that you can go through to do number five. So I'll start doing those seven. Okay, so you promise not to confuse the six preliminaries and the seven ingredients, right? Two different things. When you get to preliminary number five, you stick in the seven preliminaries. Okay? How many we got? Six plus seven is 13. You spend 5 minutes on each one, how much time? Hour and 5 minutes. Time to go to work. Okay? This stuff has to move, okay? And you have to get used to that, you know? Get the lama straight, you know? Live, breathing, warm, you know? Then move on, you know what I mean? And I know lots of Buddhists who just get stuck. They get hung up. They haven't got the right ear straight, you know, and they're like, half an hour goes by, 45 minutes goes by, they're getting drowsy. They wake up, you know, it's like 15 minutes to 9, time to rush to work, you know what I mean? It has to move. By the way, it doesn't have to be rushed. Once you get good at it, it's just moving at a nice, steady pace. You'll find out that you are not pausing to make it better. You're pausing because you're spacing out. Okay? If you really do the preliminaries in a clear, bright way, they're done in like 10 minutes, 8 minutes or something. Okay? We're describing a process that only takes about 10 minutes. Okay? If you're in retreat again, take an hour and do it nice. But if you're not in retreat, you got to get to work. You know? So let it go at a nice flow. If you get hung up on one of them and it doesn't come right, you know, like you don't remember what refuge is, it's been already 5 minutes, then just go on to the next one, okay? Leave it, all right? Okay, here's the first of the seven. Say chakcel. Chakcel. Chakcel means prostration, okay? You're sitting on your cushion. You do not get up and do a prostration, okay? It's tradition to do one just before you sit down, okay? You do three prostrations. So this one is mental, okay? This prostration is mental. And in your mind, you think of one of the great qualities of your lama, okay? It's not getting down on your knees or your tummy that collects the good karma, right? This is a trip where you're trying to get a big shot of good karma just before you go into meditation. And this can mean the difference between a good meditation and a bad meditation. You do a very, very quick chakcel. How? Think of some great quality of your lama, okay? Think of just one, okay? One holy quality of your lama that you can see, that you can recognize, okay? And And in your mind, bow down to that quality. Okay, say, I don't know what else about this Lama, but I heard one lady talk about my Lama one day. He gets mad all the time. He's always picking on me. But the one good thing, you know, he stopped for 25 years, every day, all day, and he never asked me for a penny, you know. So I said, okay, chalks out to that. You know what I mean? Like, if that's the only good thing you can see about this Lama, okay, bow down to that, you know, because even that is very rare, you know what I mean? And it's true, okay? Something you can confirm, all right? Say, chupa. Chupa. You already did a chupa. You put out the water bowls. You put out the flower. You put out... This is offering, right? And you already did one. This one you do in your mind, okay? This is much more fun. This is where you do Samanta Bhadra's offering. Is the classic one. You picture the whole sky and you fill it full of roses and other flowers, you know, and you offer that to your Lama, okay? And it's very much fun, all right? This is, at this point, everything is mental. Everything is going on in your own mind. So there's no holds barred. You have a carte blanche to make any offering you want. And you can really do some nice things, you know, be creative. I like the Pacific Ocean and some perfect surfing waves, you know, rolling in, you know, and, you know, something like that. Anything you want, you can offer. Offer them music, offer them anything. The highest offering you can do at this point is to offer some little piece of your successful Buddhist practice, okay? They would much rather have you offer 2 minutes of patience for the guy at the office that you can't stand than all of the diamonds in the world. You see what I mean? To them, that's a lot more precious. And personally, when I get to this point, I say, okay, this afternoon, when I meet that person, I'll give them a smile. It won't be sincere. It won't be too long. But, you know, as an offering to you, you know, I will smile at them. And I'm very sure to do it. You know, I try very hard to remember to do it. You know, and then I say, okay, time for you to get your offering, you know. You know, like that. You know, and do some kind of, they would much rather have a virtue, even if it's only a wimpy, half-hearted virtue, than all the gold that you could offer them or something like that. They would much rather see that. You see, if you want to do a sweet offering, offer something like that. It's like an IOU, okay? That's a very good offering. It's called Drupe Chöpa. Say Drupe Chöpa. Drupe Chöpa. The offering of your own successful practice is to them the most pleasing thing in the universe, okay? And I'm not into, frankly, ornate, expensive, you know, I don't think my Lama would want something from Saks Fifth Avenue. I've seen him throw out a lot of those things. But if I go to him and say, yeah, you know, that person I was jealous of, I controlled myself a little bit today, he gets very happy. That's really what they want from you, okay? Say, Dikshak. Dikshak. Dikpa means bad deed. The word Dikpa in Tibetan means to threaten somebody. That's Dikpa. Oh, Kongala Dikshak, you know. Hey, don't do that again, you know. That's called Dikpa. It means a bad deed in Tibetan. Shakpa means, Shakpa is the word they use in Tibetan for splitting wood open. Or splitting open a carcass or something, you know. Taking a big knife and going, shuk. And it means to open up your heart and admit something that you're doing wrong. Okay, just open it up and frankly and honestly, especially self-honestly, admit something negative that you're doing. Okay, it's very, very important when you do the preliminaries to meditation that you don't do these fuzzy, general, wimpy, oh, I'm a bad person, or I get jealous a lot, or, you know, I get cranky a lot, or something like that. We don't want to know about that. We want to know, at 3:05 yesterday, with this poor innocent guy at work, you yelled at them for 30 seconds. You know, that's a dikshak. Okay, dikshak means take some specific event in the last 24 hours, bring it up in your mind, play it back, okay? Word for word. It's an amazing exercise. This is real purification, you know? Play back word for word. This thing you said, you'll be amazed by how stupid it sounds the second or third or fourth time. you know, play back the words that you actually said to this person. You, the Bodhisattva, you know, you know, what you actually said or what you said in your mind, you know. I can't quite stand it that they're talking to that person. They should be talking to me. And then play it back like 4 or 5 times in your mind. I can't believe I thought that. You know, I can't believe my mind would say that, you know. And it's much more powerful to do something specific than some kind of general thing like, I'm a bad person, or, you know, I can't do my practice, or something like that. We want to know a specific thing that you did, that you understand what you did, and you caught yourself doing it, and then you can stop doing those things, you see? It's much more powerful, okay? D. By the way, tomorrow, when we start our session, we'll actually do a preliminary. You know, 8-minute going to work preliminary. And you'll see how it moves, and it's not uncomfortable, and it's not unnatural. You can move through them, and then you're ready to meditate. And then the meditation goes boom, and much more powerful. Okay, say Yudong.
Yudong.
Yudong is the opposite of Dikshak, okay? You look through the last 24 hours, and you find something specific to be glad about, something specific to be happy about you, okay? In the Judeo-Christian civilization that we grew up in, I'm afraid that the emphasis is on Dikshak, you know? You don't go in the Catholic Church and there's confessionals on one side and rejoicinals on the other side. You know what I mean? Like, you're supposed to go in and tell all this bad stuff, but there's no little room where you go in and say, I almost got angry, I caught myself, and I didn't do anything. And it was really good, you know, and there's no place where you can go tell the priest that. You see what I mean? If Buddhism ever gets big and we have big temples, there'll be little rooms for confession and little rooms for rejoicing, you see, and there'll be a guy sitting behind saying, that's really cool. Good job, you know. And I'm not kidding. You know, the reason you laugh is that you grew up in that Judeo-Christian guilt thing. And you are required in Buddhism to give equal airtime to rejoicing about what you're doing right, okay? Usually what you're doing right is pretty wimpy compared to what you're doing wrong. But it doesn't matter. You're supposed to give it just as much emotion and just as much joy in thinking about what a great moment this was, that after all these eons of negative lifestyle, negative thinking, I'm breaking out. You know, for 5 minutes I held my tongue. Then I blew up. Okay? I mean, the 5 minutes is the first time in a million years that you took 5 minutes out. And rejoice and be happy. You know, my lamas used to say, you know that you're doing Yudong well when you start to smile. You're sitting on your meditation seat, you're reviewing your last 24 hours, you find something right that you did, and you smile. You know, Jay Pabonka said, if you can't think of anything, be happy you're alive. Okay. Usually you can find something, okay? But he said, just that you're in a human body means that you've been very, very virtuous. You must have done a lot of good karma to be here. Okay? To have the opportunity to screw up your sadhanas and stuff like that, it's already a big virtue that you were there. You know, it's a big virtue that someone gave you that. You know what I mean? And you can be happy about that, he said. But if you're honest, you can find some great stuff, okay? And I think we have some kind of handicap like that, some mental deficiency. I don't know, and I think it's our civilization that you grow up being told, concentrate on the negatives, you're evil. You know, original sin, you know, you were there when Adam ate the apple or something, and that's your problem. You know, it's not like that. You definitely have many good things you're doing, and you are required to give it equal airtime. You are required to examine your day and find out all the cool stuff you're doing and be happy, okay? A second part of Yudong is to be happy about the good deeds of other people in the world, okay? Like, you know, I was on a ranch in Arizona a couple days ago, and this guy, I met this amazing guy. He's not a Buddhist, he's not religious, and he's so pure-hearted and talking such beautiful things and doing such nice things, and you just rejoice. You say, God, I'm glad I met a person like that, you know? And I'm glad that there's people like that around. And they say that if you do that, you get 10% of their good karma. All of the books say this. You know, all of the scriptures say that. I had a student say, you know, is the good karma of a Buddha infinite? I said, yes. They said, what's 10% of infinite? You know, like, I don't know. You know, like, you know, rejoice in Lama Sopa's activities. You know, rejoice in His Holiness's activities. You know, it doesn't, my Lama used to say, it don't cost you a dime. You know, you can sit there and rejoice and be happy and you get all this good karma. It's like riding on their coattails. You know what I mean? Karmically, you get a lot of good karma from it, okay? It's supposed to be most powerful to be happy about your own good deeds, though, okay? That's supposed to be even more powerful, okay? Say, kulwa.
Kulwa.
Kulwa. Kulwa means to... It's the full form is chunkor korwa kulwa, which means ask them to turn the wheel of the Dharma. It means make a prayer that you can have a good teaching today. Okay? Maybe it will be in a classroom with a Buddhist scripture. Maybe it will be from your child. You know, maybe it will be from your boss. Maybe it will be from the person next to you on the bus or the subway. You see what I mean? But you, at this point in your meditation, you pray that somehow today you get some kind of holy teaching from somebody. And there's a joke in Tibetan monastery. They say, then when you go to work and this guy screams at you, you can't get mad because you asked for it in the morning. You see? You said, today may I receive a holy Buddhist teaching. And then this guy like screws you at work, you know? And you're like, thank you, you know? I got it, you know, and he's testing me. He's testing me to see if I can be patient, you know. Thank you very much, you know. And so it's not just to request formal teachings. It's also to request that you see the events of your life as a teaching. And if you're doing not, and if you're studying Gyurim, this is going on all the time, okay? Say Sundep.
Sundep.
Sundep means requesting, okay? Requesting something. There's going to be two Sundeps, okay? One is going to come later. It's the last of the six. But it's also, what is it, number six of the seven, okay? And they mean different things. This Sundep means asking the lamas to stay in your life, okay? Asking them to live a long life. Asking your lamas to stay with you throughout your life, okay? To continue to stay in your world. If you keep this kind of thing up, then Lama Sopa's health starts to get better. You see what I mean? If you keep praying for it, because his health is empty, your karma starts to change his health. And they say, oh, he's feeling much better. He looks better. He's lost weight. His tone is increasing. It looks like he can do a 3-year retreat with us. And that's all the result of your own karma, okay? You're making him healthy, okay? And this is requesting them to stay in your life, stay healthy, okay? Also applies to your Dharma friends, okay? Your lamas teach you a lot, but it's your friends. It's your Dharma friends that you live with and you're practicing with and you're going to class with them. If they're good, your practice is great. You see what I mean? So you pray for their long life also. Pray that they stay in your life. Okay? Oftentimes a good Dharma friend or two is more effective than a Lama that you only see once in a while. You see what I mean? Much more powerful in keeping you straight and keeping you on a good keel. And you can do it with each other. You know what I mean? When one person's feeling down, the other person helps them. And then when the other person's feeling down, you help them. And this kind of relationship is very important. So in the verse, it says, pray for the long life of your Dharma brothers and sisters, okay? Last one. Something happens between here and the last of the seven, okay? Something happens between there. We got to number six within number five, right? We're on the sixth of the seven limbs of the seven-limb puja. Something's got to happen here before you go on to number seven. What? You meditate. All right? This is where you're supposed to stop and do your meditation, all right? The preliminaries are over. The warm-up is over. This is where you start the 50-yard dash, okay? Right here. Personally, I take a little break because by then you've already been sitting about 10 or 15 minutes, okay? I take a break. I let myself move around. I start to go back to my breath again. You know, it's like in Tibetan they say tsamshu. It means it's a threshold. You know, you're about to go into deep meditation. So I take the opportunity, you know, I move my arms a little bit. I get back into a good position. I sit up straight again. And I do a breath thing again. I do another 10 breaths or 20 breaths, you know, because the conceptual part is done. You see what I mean? The part where you're purposely letting your mind wander to all your Dharma friends and your Lama and rejoicing. Your mind has been in Dharamsala, rejoicing with His Holiness. And now it's time to come to meditate. So I take this opportunity to take a little, you know, I straighten up again, take a few deep breaths, you know, look around, and then watch the breath again, and then go into a deep state of meditation. Okay, this is where you do it. Okay, and supposedly by this time your mind is totally, totally into it, and you are. If you get good at this, the whole preliminary is like a jet starting to take off. You know, and just when you get to this point, the wheels are leaving the ground. You know, and then your mind just slides into this deep meditation. It's not a big leap. You know, it's not like coming home from your job, throwing off your tie and your coat and sitting on the meditation cushion. You know, you've warmed up, taken this long speed thing down the runway, and now you just slide into it. It's really a nice feeling. You just slide right into this deep state of meditation. It's like going off a diving board or something. And then suddenly you're in this deep meditation, okay? And your mind is really, really mellow and really, really clean and pure. You know, 10 minutes after you get up, it won't be that way anymore. But right after all these preliminaries, your mind is very, very mellow and very, very right. And then you go right into a deep meditation, okay? We'll talk about the different kinds of meditation later, you know. How do you get into the deep meditation? And that's all. You'll be meditating then for 45 minutes or an hour, okay? At the beginning, you can do 10 or 15 minute chunks. And then come out and take some breaths and then go back down, go back in, okay? And that's all. I'm not going to talk about the actual meditation. We'll do that tomorrow. Now you start to come out, okay? So I'm talking now an hour later, okay? 1 hour later or whatever, okay? And by the way, when I say you should meditate for an hour, I mean deep meditation for an hour. That don't count when I say an hour, okay? That first 15, 20 minutes doesn't count, okay? Now you need to be in deep meditation for an hour, okay? Now you're starting to come out, you do the seventh of the seven limb puja, okay? Say ngoa. Ngoa. Ngoa means dedication. You have that paper in your notebook that we do after class. Gewa di, gewa kun, sunam yeshi tsoto jin, sunam yeshi lechi wen damakun yishtam wachon. Who wrote that? Nagarjuna, 17 centuries ago, okay? I just did a... Noah means dedication of the good karma, okay? Sitting and meditating for an hour, thinking about emptiness for an hour, if you keep that up, you will get enlightened quickly, okay? That's a really good karma, okay? Out of a 24-hour day, at least 1 hour... you spent in perfect good karma. There's a thing called pratimoksha vows, bodhisattva vows, tantric vows. Do you know there's a thing called meditation vow? Samtengi domba. It means while you're in meditation and going through one of these preliminaries, you don't have time to lie to somebody. You don't have time to kill somebody. It's like automatic good karma by default. Okay? And that's in the Abhidhamma, it's called Samtengi domba, you know. You can rejoice, you know. You just did 1 hour of pure good karma. You can't do that at work, you know. I mean, you're going to get irritated with somebody in 60 minutes, you know, or you're going to have a negative thought about one of your suppliers or one of your customers. It definitely will come. But here, for 1 hour, you did something good, straight good deeds for 1 hour. This is amazing. You know, that's a great karma. So then you dedicate it. You say, all that good karma, I like to say it's like throwing a rock in a pond. you know, and all this ripple effect comes out, okay, you'll find out that if you meditate, you'll be much less likely to get irritated at work or upset at work or stressed at work. And people will say something to you, and because you've been meditating and preparing for that, you don't respond. And then someone's watching you, and then there's this subconscious ripple hits them. They say, wow, this is weird. He didn't even get upset. And then somebody else is watching them, and the ripple hits them, and the ripple hits them, and the ripple hits them. And this is like a rippling effect of a meditator. And you don't even know you're doing it. You know, you sit at work. You see the emptiness of the guy yelling at you. You respond as a real Buddhist. And it has this reverberations around the office. It has this ripple effect throughout the office. And then sooner or later, everybody in the office is affected. Dedicate that. Okay? As you come out of the meditation, say, I pray that this good karma will touch all the people around me, and then they'll touch somebody else, and they'll touch somebody else. I imagine that if you're a good Buddhist in Manhattan, that by the end of the day, the rippling from your good, from your meditation has touched thousands of people, you see? Subconsciously, like that. So you dedicate that good karma, okay? And I like to, at this point in your meditation, you're about to stand up. You're about to come out of your meditation. Dedicate it to something specific, okay? If you know someone who's not well, dedicate it to them. You know, if you're having trouble understanding a text on emptiness, dedicate it to your understanding, you know? If you're trying to practice some tantric stuff, dedicate it to the success of your tantric practice, you know? If you heard that some lama is not well, dedicate it to that, you know? But dedicate it to something specific, okay? Don't do this, you know, all fuzzy, you know, God bless Tiny Tom and everybody else, you know? I mean, do this specific visualization of something that you want to dedicate it to. It's much more powerful, okay? After Ngoa, you go back to the sixth preliminary, which is not really, two of these are not preliminaries, right? Ngoa comes afterwards. And the sixth preliminary in this system comes afterwards, okay? Here's the last preliminary, and then we're done for today, okay? We're back to preliminary number six, right? All of that A, B, C, D, E, F, G stuff, seven limbs, that happened under number five. The first six of them happened before you go into meditation, and the seventh one happened after you stopped meditating, okay? And here's the last one. Say, Sundep. We already had a Sundep, okay? What Sundep was that? What were you requesting? Long life. Okay, stay in my life. Please stay in my life, you know? You do like, you know, please stay with me. Please stay in my life, okay? And this Sundep is different. This is, please give me your blessings, okay? Who? This dude or dudess who is sitting in front of you, okay? This lama, okay? It's considered very impolite to leave them hanging. You know, get up and go to work. This poor guy's got to sit there till the next morning. Okay? All right? You have to do something with them, all right? Whether you are visualizing the 64 deities or Chakrasambhara's mandala, which God bless if you can, I can't. Or whether it's just this one sweet lama and their face is kind of fuzzy and everything, you know? And you got to do something with them, okay? And you ask them, please bless my heart, you know? And please give me your blessing. And this is called Gyun Denge. Say Gyun Denge. Gyun Denge. Okay, that's the last thing before you stand up, okay? And it's the part of the Sundep. What are you asking for here on this last Sundep? You're asking them to bless you, okay? And the way they do it is this. You visualize them rising up off the ground. And as they rise, they get smaller and smaller and smaller. So there are two things are going on. They're coming up off the ground, and they're starting to munchkinize, all right? And then they turn. Halfway in the air, they turn around, and then they come up to the top of your head like that. And they sit there for a second. And at that point, they're like 3 or 4 inches high. Okay, so you got this little lama there. Okay, and now he's facing or she's facing the same way that you are. Okay? And then I'll tell you a secret teaching, okay? Not so secret. You have a central channel going down in front of your spiritual channel going down in front of your backbone, just in front of your backbone. It's very, very straight. It doesn't end here, but you can imagine an opening here, okay? And you ask them to bless you. And then you shrink them, shrink them, shrink them, shrink them, shrink them, shrink them, shrink them. The central channel is like as thick as, in the scripture it says, as thick as a piece of straw. Like a McDonald's straw is about the same, okay? And you imagine them that they can fit quite nicely inside of that. And they're coming down straight. And you can feel them coming down. And it's like this, they're emanating like some golden light. It's warm. It's like some kind of very warm honey coming down your spine. And if you get a little thrill up your spine, it's a good sign. You know, they're coming down, down, down. It's not in your spinal cord, okay? It's in front of your backbone. Between your chest, between here, and it's supposed to be like half an inch in front of your backbone, straight, running straight down. And you feel them coming down, 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 and they park in your heart. And then right there you see this golden light, and it's like a little cow, like a little capsule right here. And they're sitting there. They say it's like a pea, okay? Like in the middle of a pea. And they've got this lotus, they're sitting. I like to picture them on a rose flower. I'm better with roses than lotuses, okay? And they're on this beautiful flower, they're sitting there, and they're very, very happy, they're very relaxed, they're very beautiful, they're very warm, they're sensual, they're warm, they smell good, they're breathing, and they're parked there in your central channel right behind your heart. And it just, you feel that, and you keep them there, and you imagine that they are blessing you all that time. You know, that there's some... It's like those nicotine patches, you know. It's like all day long it's like leaking into your central channel. You know, this love and compassion and knowledge of emptiness is leaking out of them, and it's like going throughout your body the whole day. It's very comforting when you have a bad day, you know, like you're stuck in traffic or you drop something on your foot or something like that, and you go to them. You say, you know, help me out. They say, oh, I'm here, don't worry, everything will be all right. You know, and you take some comfort, you know, and keep visualizing them there. And from time to time during the day, focus on them, that they're there, and they love you, and they want to be there, and they're very, very happy with you. There's this joy thing that's supposed to be happening all the time. You know, all the texts say, looks gold, two hands, one face, one, two eyes, big nose, and loves you, you know what I mean? And they always say that at the end, you know. They're like madly in love with you. And there's this thing radiating in your body, okay? And that's gyu means mental continuum, your mind stream, okay? De means mixed. De nge means totally mixed, fused together. Who? You and them, okay? And this exercise of bringing them into you is, think to yourself, I'm like you, you know. I got this little piece of you in me. And now I can act like you. I can start to look like you. I can start to move my arms like you. I can start to talk like you. I can start to think like you. Because I got a little piece of you in me. And then you, all day long, you like emulate this being, you know. If you're doing it with His Holiness or Lama Tsupa, it's a great blessing, you know. Like you're walking down the street and you say, I'm Lama Tsupa. You know, and I'm walking down the street, you know. I love everybody. No one can piss me off, you know. And I'm compassionate. You know, and you just walk down the street, it's called Nagyal. Nagyal means you identify with Lama Tsupa, you know. And he's in your heart, or His Holiness, or anyone else that is holy. And you're just walking down the street, and you're saying, I'm acting like Lama Tsupa. I talk like Lama Tsupa. I think like Lama Tsupa, you know. Nobody can upset me, much less, you know, I'm emanating care and compassion for everybody, you know, I'm above all that. When I get to work and my boss is screaming at me, I'm like, he's like my kid, you know, and I'm like, oh, Johnny, you know, I love you, I'll take care of you, you know, whatever you need, you know, and instead of getting angry at him, you see what I mean, and you're a totally different person. And that's what Yun Deng En means. You like become fused with your Lama, and you start to become your Lama, okay? And I'm talking about the idealized Lama, okay? Never gets jealous, never gets angry, physically perfect, you know, emanation body. And you start to think like that and carry yourself like that, you know, like, I am them, you know, and I'm above all, you know, I'm a bodhisattva. I would never get upset with anybody, much less, you know. I would stay at the office for 4 extra hours and shine their shoes for them, you know. And, you know, that's the way I relate to my boss, you know, and... And it's very, you become very powerful. You know, you become a tantric deity, really. You know what I mean? So you go, it's like practicing for later, okay? It's like pretending that you're already them, okay? And that's the final part of meditation, all right? So when you get up, you're not you anymore. You're Gyundang Emi. You're 50% Lama Sopa when you stand up, okay? And then you act like that the whole day. It's very powerful, okay? Very good way to meditate, all right? We'll stop there. And then in the morning when we start the session, I'll take you through our preliminaries. You might want to bring a tape recorder if you have one, because then you can play it sometimes in your house and you make sure you won't miss a step. You know, you can do it, play it for like a week, and then you don't need it anymore, okay? And we'll go through a normal preliminary tomorrow. I don't know, what time is it tomorrow? 9:30? Yeah, what time? Is this one of those 9:30, 10 o'clock things?
Yeah.
I think they told you 9:30, so you'd be here at 10, okay? So, all right. 9:30. Okay.
Guru Rana Mandala Kamiyatayami.
Tuesday is Sechu, and we'll do a Vajrayogini. If you have that initiation, you're welcome to come around. Is it 2 o'clock?
Yeah.
2 o'clock here in the temple. Okay, if you don't have that initiation, you cannot come. I'd like to do it in Tibetan, which is the way we do it in our temple, and if you don't have a copy, then ask one of the people from New York, and they can loan you something. The next 2 days, you can Xerox it or something, okay? And then we'll do just a very traditional seichu. And then it's custom to bring some offerings, okay? Yeah? Where will I be? What time is that? Ooh. We'll do it after class, okay? Her time is the midnight hour, actually, so that'll be fine. Okay, so after class on Tuesday, which is even better for Vajrayogini, okay? That's a custom, so is that all right? Okay, excuse me? After the night class, huh? Yeah, after the evening class. Okay, I mean, we'll take a break and then we'll start. And actually, it's more auspicious to do it around, if you go into midnight, it's very auspicious, okay? That's her favorite time of day, okay? All right. Yeah,